Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Oh, Shenandoah, it's far I wander. Away, rolling river. Oh, Shenandoah, it's far I wander.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We Americans are often the last to know about our own national treasures in the arts. And this week, in our focus on American voices as part of the American Music Festival, we're taking a look at the American song tradition because that has been a particular case of musical oversight. Baritone Thomas Hampson has spent much of his career working to change that. This season, he's been on an 11-city Song of America tour. This series of recitals have been accompanied by a traveling exhibition from the Library of Congress with displays of historical musical manuscripts by Gershwin, Copland, Stephen Foster, and others. The tour concludes tomorrow with a recital in San Jose, California. Joining us in advance is Thomas Hampson. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Now, you've sung some pretty heavy-duty opera roles, Wagner's Parsifal at the Met, Macbeth in London earlier this year. What is it about these songs that keeps pulling you back during the course of many years?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I've always sung songs. As you well know, I sing a lot of recitals in various languages, and probably mostly in German, but certainly French and Italian as well, but always as well the American song repertoire. And I started my career singing songs, American songs on recitals, and maybe it's because of the schooling I had or the people I was in contact with. I was raised, meaning vocally raised by a singer who knew a lot of this repertoire, probably more the European repertoire. But it was always self-understood to sing John Duke, Samuel Barber, Stephen Foster, of course, everyone grows up with. And the programs just sort of grew and matured as I grew and matured.
You know, it's funny that you say that about Stephen Foster, because everybody does seem to grow up with Stephen Foster. He's part of our collective inheritance as Americans. And yet, I would bet that 8 or 9 out of 10 Americans could sing through any number of his songs and not be able to tell you who wrote them.
That's a wonderful point. You're absolutely right. Not only here in America, but in Europe and even Southeast Asia. There's a story about an evangelical priest who was in Japan and heard a Japanese orchestra or some sort of cocktail band, really, playing a Stephen Foster melody. And he said, "Oh my God, how do you know our melodies from America? You know, what, it's a wonderful Stephen Foster melody." He said, "Oh, no, this is our music." He said, "Well, no, it isn't your music." And they come ensued this huge argument. It turns out that as Japan opened, in fact, some of the first people that came were from his religion and whatever, missionaries and whatever, and they sang Foster songs. And they became part of, my point is, they became part of the folk element. And not so much that people don't know that it was Stephen Foster, but actually most people think that a lot of these very, very popular songs are folk songs from America and don't realize they belong to a person.
Right.
And it was actually the German Curiosity, about 12, 15 years ago, asked me, Hessische Rundfunk in Stuttgart, said, would you do a Stephen Foster program? And they came over here. We went down to Pittsburgh, Dean Rutz Memorial, Stephen Foster Memorial. He runs it down there at the University of Pittsburgh. And we did a huge thing on Thomas Moore, Robert Burns, and of course, mostly Stephen Foster for German television. We tried to sell it, give it, bag it over here, and we didn't get a lot of interest. It's now perhaps we'll get it shown sometime.
So Song of America, this 11-city tour, is it telling a story? Is it just kind of a wake-up call to say this is our heritage?
Well, you know, I want to be really careful about this. There's nothing finger-wagging about this tour. There's no ultimate agenda or mission other than the celebration of our culture through song, which is, without question, song storytelling. It's not about really art song more than the idea of song. I like to refer to what my specialty is, or my field, as concert song, because that puts it in a kind of perspective that's perhaps different than a folk fest or a rock concert.
And curiously, yet there you were doing Shenandoah.
Well, sure. And Shenandoah is a folk song. I didn't know until this year that it has 26 verses. I have yet to sing them all. And it's actually about this poor guy who falls in love with Shenandoah's daughter, you know, and he's an Indian chief. And so the whole thing, we sort of synthesize it into these wonderful sort of valley, rivers, and oh my God, I have to leave home thing, when actually it's a very specific story of all things. And it's very fun to watch how folk music becomes folk music. And I've just been celebrating in Germany the 200-year anniversary of the first publication of the Youth's Magic Horn, or Des Knabenwunderhorn, as we know it in German, primarily from Gustav Mahler. But a lot of people set that poetry. And it's fun to see how people like Herder and Müller and even people like Carlyle and Emerson spoke of folk music and folk song. It really is about the effect that it has on the folk, more than finding that person in the Ur place with the Ur voice singing the Ur song. So it's quite an interesting relationship to the people hearing as well as singing.
And it seems that in American song in particular, there is a blurring at some point of the distinction between the art song and the popular song.
Very much so. And I think that comes from the storytelling element. It comes from the fact also what I love about American song, which is very much different than the European art song, as it were. And that is that to look for a composer or even a poet who embodies the best of what we have to offer in America is a useless search. It is always about the various epochs, phases, generations, problems, social conundrums, immigration issues, how about apropos, that come about first and foremost through the poetry, and then into the eyes and use of composers. And we also have composers writing huge amounts of songs, of which one epoch and generation they hit spot on, and either they didn't make it before that or they fall off of it afterwards. And so there's a great discrepancy of quality, quite frankly. But it's the concert song is certainly, as much as we like our arrangements of folk songs, it is certainly more centered around that powerful poetic narration of the human, the development of the American psyche, quite frankly. We can look at how we have become America through our song.
Well, and especially in the case of Stephen Foster writing as he did during a very wrenching period of American history when modern America really was being formed in terms of relations between the states, relations between the races.
And also immigration issues. You know, Stephen Foster was very sensitive to the slave situation. He was very aware of the displacement. And, of course, we can never forget the 40s and the 50s, enormous Irish immigration.
1840s and 50s.
1840s yes. and 50s, okay. Exactly.
But in the case of Hard Times Come Again No More, for many years, perhaps for a century or more, when you said Stephen Foster, you thought Jeannie of the Light Brown Hair and, you know, Swanee River and any number of other songs. This is the now Stephen Foster song,
yeah,
Hard Times.
Without question. And probably the most arranged American song by another American and composer by country, western, and folk musicians, so forth and so on. It's just endless arrangements and renditions of this unbelievable song. It's been great fun to come back and sing it to people in its sort of Stephen Foster original, as it were.
With Molly Mason and Jay Unger backing you up on this.
Well, this is actually, I have to be honest, this is our rendition. This is also an augmentation. But just to do the piano version is also quite interesting. But I remember doing this. Jay Unger's and Molly, they're great. This is great.
Thomas Hampson's my guest.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sup sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
Hard Times Come Again No More from the American songwriter Stephen Foster. And my guest is the American baritone Thomas Hampson, based in Vienna, lo these many years, but obviously, you know, keeping close tabs on the American music scene.
You know, I travel so much. I'm based in a suitcase. You know, I've got my library in Vienna, and I've got some of it over here, and, you know, it's a pretty peripatetic life, if I may be so bold.
Well, Thomas Hampson has joined us during our American Music Festival as we are focusing in on American voices, and really, the sound of the collective American voice was being formed around the time that Stephen Foster was writing songs. He was the first kind of great American tunesmith, you know, in terms of having hit records,
hit songs
that went beyond regions and eventually went beyond the sort of accepted racial profiles of the day.
Well, you know, we could spend the whole time talking about Stephen Foster, which is fun and good, and I'm not an apologist for Stephen Foster. I do believe that we have to look at our own history in America, and we have to hate the things that are truly wrong and change them and be quicker to change them. But I think we need to leave the people that lived in the epochs alone, or at least only hold those accountable that are truly accountable for grievous errors. Foster wasn't. Foster was apolitical. He was everything. He had lived a rather desolate life. That notwithstanding, the essence of his songs were neither to exploit white or exploit black. He wrote in the first parts of his career how people wrote songs about subjects that wrote songs that got performed and were popular and so forth. And they were, I can't say they were harmless because they weren't harmless. Curious, there's a couple of curious facts about Stephen Foster. One, it is all original material, which is kind of amazing. And two, the minute he had any control over the publishing of his music, this is one of the few forceful things he did, he immediately said, get that black caricature nonsense off the front of my music. This is not about a race. This is about people. And then we have songs like Nellie Was a Lady. Nellie Was a Lady is a love song about a woman who died, and the man can hardly work, and he travels all day long, and he can't. But it's the scene through the eyes of an African-American family. Mm-hmm. This did not exist in our country at that time. So I think we need to recognize what was wrong and improprietous and so forth and so on, but not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, and we don't need to go much further down the American timeline to find another really distinctive and watershed moment in the formation of the American voice. And it's not a songwriter in this case, but a poet, and that is Walt Whitman.
Oh, wow. Walt Whitman.
whose various musical settings are a part of your Song of America tour as well.
Walt Whitman, you know, it's amazing that it took us so long to recognize him for the prophetic voice that he was, both for the human psyche, the American psyche, and quite frankly, the voice of democracy. It'd be very good for all of us interested people and those of us in government to buy a few volumes of his work and have a closer look at what he was saying. There's a wonderful respect and rejoicing in the individualism in this country, and the bonding of togetherness, or the respect for one another to live one another, and the tolerance of one another, that does not mean that you sell yourself out. Exactly the opposite. You are patient to have other people understand you.
Yeah.
I'm very fond of Walt Whitman.
Well, and, you know, his poetry has been set over the years many, many times by American composers, both homegrown, and you brought up the immigrant, you know, nature of our country, Kurt Weill, you know?
Weill adored Whitman, and he made these four settings on Whitman poetry. One, I think we're going to hear the Dirge for Two Veterans, which is really quite beautiful. You know, curious enough, Whitman was recognized and set to music first by English composers, and he was actually first known internationally through the publication of the Rossetti family, Daniel Gabriele Rossetti, who published the first volume in Europe of Whitman, and that's actually what splashed him into the international scene. Then it started working sort of backwards over here. Emerson was very, very supportive of him at the beginning, but once all the terribly personal references and the Body Electric and started to appear, America just wasn't quite ready for that. But of course, he is the singular great voice of the insanity of war, and his drum taps and the Civil War songs are probably, or Civil War poetry, are probably the most beautiful of that tragic time.
And, you know, as with all great poetry, not bound to the specifics
exactly.
of the time and
exactly.
the war, because here's Kurt Weill between the wars, you know, fleeing Nazi Germany, mm. finding a haven in this country, and finding resonance in this poetry of Walt
and
Whitman.
And by the way, Kurt Weill insisted. The minute he landed here and stayed here, he said his name is Weill.
Point well taken. So here's Kurt Weill, and my guest is Thomas Hampson. This is his performance of Weill's Dirge for Two Veterans.
The last sunbeam lightly falls from the finished Sabbath on the pavement here, and there beyond it is lurking.
Dirge for Two Veterans by Kurt Weill, setting of a text by Walt Whitman. My guest is the baritone Thomas Hampson, who is about to conclude an 11-city Song of America tour with the Library of Congress. And you've actually done a fair amount of kind of big projects over the years.
I have, and this has been, in some ways, you know, the next step. And it's been a great tour this year. We're not done. This is the first phase. It was a big launching phase, but it has to do with a very long-going and deep relationship that I have with the Library of Congress in the development of their website, the Music Division website, and the building of a database cross-referencing American poetry and American song composers. I would like to help initiate a massive listening library. I think listening libraries with the new technology would be a great service to all kinds of music, but certainly classical music. People just don't have the familiarity that they would like to have, and it's a rather daunting task to get familiar. I have nothing but interest in making things more accessible and connecting dots with people, not even for people, but with people. And I think that's one of the things that the library can do, and they do so well anyway in so many other genres. So it's a very massive ongoing project. I'll be down there for years and have been down there for years. It's an incredible archive, millions of pieces of music and poetry. The website is enormous. James Billington's Vision for Creativity in America is a spectacular program and a very beautiful quest in the name of our library, which is the people's library. It's not the government's mm-hmm. library. I'm standing in Kansas City, you know, holding Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, of course, with gloves inside of plastic, but it's his
you
manuscript.
Holding the manuscript.
The manuscript. These manuscripts that we've been taking on the road and doing educational venues and so forth, but also for the general public. In the foyer, while I'm singing, in the intermission, people go out and look at these manuscripts. These have not been outside of the library because everybody's scared to death. The insurance is a nightmare. You know, God bless, it's incredible. And it's such this, that's why I meant at the beginning, it's not a finger-wagging tour. It's a celebration tour. It's a let's look at ourselves. Let's look at this contradictory, convoluted, difficult, contrary thing we call American culture, and let's smile. Let's look at each other, buy each other a cup of coffee, and agree to disagree. Let's move on here. Let's celebrate the good stuff. Let's build good people, and then we'll have better politicians, and we'll have a better country. We'll move forward with open eyes. We won't be completely drastically fearful of everything we think we have to be fearful of, because we've already been through it. We're just not listening and reading what we've already done as a great country.
So it's not just about
And another thing. And I'm not even running for anything.
But you're wagging your finger at me.
I'm saying it's not waving, you know. I'm sorry. I get kind of wound up because I just find this material, this repertoire, so unbelievably enriching and beautiful and fascinating.
But at the end of the day, it's not just about the repertoire. It's about what it means. And we talk about the formation of an American voice. And it's what does it mean to be American? And you read Walt Whitman and you listen to Stephen Foster. And then you follow what composers have done with Whitman through the course of a century and a half, and you begin to think.
And if you open it up as an evidence of who we are, then you start celebrating quote-unquote minor poets and minor composers or people forgotten, like an Egbert McDowell or a Charles Griffiths or a John Alden Carpenter. I'm actually naming names that were big deals in their lifetime. You know, how about the poetry of Edgar Allington Robinson? When was the last time you read a poem like Miniver Cheevy or Richard Corey or Lou Cavergall? I mean, these are wonderful portraits of American psychologies and people. You know, when you move up into somebody like, of course, Copland's very famous, but for instance, a John Duke. John Duke has written more songs than Jules Massenet, you know, almost 300 songs. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, can you whistle a tune? He's one of the great American song composers, Samuel Barber, of course, and Virgil Thompson and so forth, and ad infinitum. Women composers, you know, all sorts of racial connections.
So this, all of this is what you're hoping for from this Library of Congress project.
Well, it has been. The programs have been around. Like William Grant Still, one of the great American composers, fantastic, the dean of African American composers. Okay, fine. He's having a bit of a renaissance. But, you know, let's look at the Harlem Renaissance, for mm-hmm. instance. Let's look at women composers. Eleanor Remick Warren, a wonderful example of private American creativity, you know. Chapter in American history, 92 years old, lived and studied with Frank LaForge here in New York and ended her life in California, wrote wonderful oratorios, hundreds of songs, accompanied Richard Crooks and Lawrence Tibbett, John Charles Thomas, Nelson Eddy. You know, of course, the whole thing is also the issue of publication. That's why the library comes into play. The things that are in public domain, hey, let's get them out there. Let's have a look. Let's make them accessible.
Now, for people who really want to find out more about what you're doing with this project, mm-hmm. we have a link to your website on the Soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. We're speaking with the American baritone Thomas Hampson. Our final bit of music as we wrap up actually is, you mentioned John Duke, 300 songs. That's very impressive. Ned Roram, he passed 300 decades ago.
Yes, decades ago. Exactly. Ned Roram is certainly the dean of American song.
All right. When he's not in libraries, Thomas Hampson can be found touring around. Really? You find time for that too?
I try.
I find that hard to believe, but okay. Tomorrow he will be in San Jose, concluding his Song of America tour with the Library of Congress, an 11-city tour. And we hear a little bit of the music of Ned Roram and the poetry of Walt Whitman starting up in the background. Thomas Hampson, always a pleasure to have you with us on WNYC.
Thanks, John.
In a moment, the Pakistani band Junoon has been dubbed the U2 of Asia. Their lead guitarist, Salman Ahmad, will perform live here in our studio. And then later, hear about a classic Sinatra album that should be avoided if you find yourself lying awake at 4 a.m. Stay with us.